Martin Gay.
May it please the court, Mr. Carl Bernard Adams, to give arguments for the petitioner.
Please report. My name is Carl David Adams with the Dallas law firm of Adams Francis, and we're here today to present the arguments for the petitioners in this case, Mr. and Mrs. Charles Hoffman. This is a lawsuit brought by the petitioners, Mr. and Mrs. Hoffman, under their Texas all-risk homeowners insurance policy issued in 1979 by Employers Insurance Company, the respondent, seeking to recover damages in market value of the home and additional living expenses caused to the petitioners when a third party, Allied Pest Control, negligently applied insecticides to their home after making numerous misrepresentations that the jury found were deceptive trade practices violations. The facts of this case are that on August 31, 1981, a few months before the office home was to be paid for, they decided that they had too many carpet feet, and so they contacted Allied Pest Control and requested that they rid the carpet beetles from the house, and they did so. They sprayed a chemical that was nerve-banding. This was contrary to what they had told the office they were going to spray, and it was contrary to what they told the office they had sprayed after they sprayed. And apparently they mixed it in a way that was inconsistent with the manufacturer's instructions, and they applied it in a way that was inconsistent with the instructions, and they applied it in places that were inconsistent with where they told the Altons they were going to apply. And the end result was that the Altons could not live in the home anymore, were forced to abandon it, as well as all their personal property, including their furniture and clothes and so forth, living in hotels, what have you. They, as you can imagine, sued Allied Pest Control for negligence, misrepresentation in the Consumer Protection Act, etc. In addition, they filed a suit that, at the request of Employers, was consolidated with the tortfeasor lawsuit, a claim against the all-risk insurance policy issued by Employers. They filed a claim under that policy, and that claim was denied. And as we stand here today, no part of that claim has ever been paid by Employers. The jury found that the claims adjustment policies or practices in this case by Employers were not undertaken in good faith. They were also asked and found that the physical loss to the dwelling was not caused by contamination, one of the principal defenses advanced by Employers. After the trial was over with, the verdict was in, some $350,000 or $60,000 worth of actual damages to the petitioners identified. The petitioners settled with the tortfeasor for some $295,000. Thereafter, the fight continued between the petitioners and the Employers Insurance Company, both parties filing motions for judgment. In the trial court, the Altons asked the judge to enter a judgment for the diminished market value of their home and the increased living expenses, both of which were claimed to be covered by the insurance policy, plus attorney's fees and deceptive trade practices damages, claiming that the bad faith of the insurance carrier was an unconscionable form of conduct that took advantage of the position of the Altons as insurers under the policy. The Employers Insurance Company asked the trial court to enter a judgment of zero. Number one, because they said the loss was caused by contamination, which was excluded under the policy's terms, they claimed. And number two, that he should give them a credit by reason of the fact that they claimed that settlement between the petitioners and the tortfeasor, Allied Pest Control, had destroyed what they claimed were subrogation rights that somehow or another existed even though the claim never been paid. The trial court refused to do what either side requested and entered its own judgment. That judgment did not award the petitioners any damages, but did award them attorney's fees. We have studied long and hard, and about the only way we think that judgment could be rationally understood is an adoption of the segregation arguments that were made by Employers in the trial court. Both sides, as you could have probably predicted, appealed that judgment to the Court of Appeals in Dallas for the Fifth District. That court reversed and rendered a decision and declared that factually, as a matter of law, that this case represented a situation where the loss, as a matter of law, was caused by contamination, and therefore the court concluded was excluded by the insurance policy in question. There are two major issues in this appeal that are before the court today, and they are that the first issue was whether or not this loss was in fact excluded by the contamination clause, and whether the treatment of contamination by the Court of Appeals was correct. And secondly, if it was not, whether employers in fact was entitled to the type of subrogation offset or use of an offset by reason of their subrogation claims that the trial court allowed them. First, with regard to contamination, paragraph subsection I of the property section of the homeowner's all-risk policy states that this insurance policy does not cover loss caused by, and then it lists five or six different items, one of which is contamination. In the trial court, Special Issue 14 asked the jury, do you find from a preponderance of the evidence that physical loss of the dwelling at 4115 Fallen Hollow, Dallas, Texas, was not caused by contamination? And we gave the definition that contamination was a condition of impurity or impairment resulting from mixture or contact with a foreign substance. I don't believe either party objected to that definition. The jury answered in the affirmative that they found that it was not caused by contamination. Employers asked the trial judge to disregard Issue 14, and he refused to do so. On appeal, the Court of Appeals, in effect, granted an NOV, disregarded Issue 14, and made their own fact-finding that, in fact, as a matter of law, the facts of this case established contamination factually was the cause of this loss. And, in effect, we claim substituted their own factual decision for that of the jury on this causation issue. We're here to say that this, whereas here, the loss is, in fact, caused by third-party misconduct or negligence, which is certainly what the fact finder of fact found, and not by some natural form of contamination, that the exclusion in this particular policy, placed as it is placed, in the location where it is, among other natural conditions arising in nature, does not and cannot apply to exclude recovery under the all-risk policy of the state of Texas. If we look at the exclusion itself, it says that if this insurance shall not cover, and in subsection I, the entire paragraph reads as follows, loss caused by inherent vice, wear and tear, deterioration, rust, rot, mold, or other fungus, dampness of atmosphere, extremes of temperature, contamination, vermin, termites, moths, or other insects. Now, all of the losses in paragraph I, with the exception of contamination, are very clearly losses that arise from natural occurrences. Vermin and insects and mice very rarely are the result of third-party conduct. Likewise, dampness and rot and rain and things like this are in the main entirely natural in origin. And the paragraph itself, we feel, is important to the determination of what this exclusion means. Now, the Court of Appeals said a number of things that we have disagreement with. First of all, they cited the case of Travelers versus McKillop, which is a 1971 Supreme Court case. They cited that case for the proposition that where there are more than one cause of an event, or two concurrent causes, and one of the concurrent causes is excluded by the insurance policy, that the entire loss is excluded. We don't believe that's what the case says. We believe that that case simply allows for a segregation of damages as between the two concurrent causes. In our case, we don't think we have concurrent causes. The jury didn't find concurrent causes. The jury found causes that were arising in a third party's negligence, and in the third party's misrepresentations that led to the consumer transaction. And so therefore, if we have concurrent colleges, they're both colleges that are covered by the policy we claim, and none are excluded. One of the cases that the Court of Appeals relied upon was the Hallmark case, found on page 11 of their slip opinion. That case, it dealt with underground water exclusion. And in that case, it was a 1978 NRE decision that principally makes a very similar argument to the argument that you make here today. That is that where there is an insured peril and damage occurs that arguably is the type of damage that might be excluded by the policy, that you should construe that in favor of the insurance owner, the insurer. Excuse me, the insurer. The Hallmark case, although was cited by the court to support its position, we don't believe is the law anymore. In 1982, we found a case with the Dallas Court of Appeals, Adrian Associates versus National Security Corporation, and this is not in our brief, we only found it recently. It found at 638 Southwest 2nd, 138. In that case, underground water caused by a broken municipal water line had created a foundation problem that caused the foundation to buckle and damage the home. And the argument was made that the underground water exclusion excluded the claim. In that particular case, the carrier cited the case of Park versus Hanover. Park versus Hanover is identical on its facts to the Hallmark case. It's an underground water case. Insured make a claim that third-party perils are perils that were not excluded and followed the laws and so forth. The Park case was cited and expressly overruled or rejected, if you will, by the Adrian case. And this court was asked to grant an NRE, or to grant a writ. And it, in an NRE opinion of approximately two paragraphs long in 1983, found at 650 Southwest 2nd, page 67, this court expressly approved the Adrian reasoning, which expressly rejected the Park decision.
What was the last site, please?
The last site was 650 Southwest 2nd, page 67, a 3 NRA opinion. Even though the Hallmark case was not mentioned in Adrian, nor by the court's NRA opinion, since the two cases can hardly even be distinguished, they involve the same theory, the same approach to the problem, and since the Hallmark case comes before either the Adrian case or our case, we say the Hallmark case is no longer the law. And now that I realize that's a position that we didn't take in our brief, and quite frankly we didn't find that until after that case has been granted, because it's on a different type of exception, although the reasoning is almost identical to the reasoning we make here. The problem in our case with regard to contamination is that the word contamination, standing alone as it clearly does, can be taken to describe a condition caused by some form of peril, and it can be taken to describe a form of peril itself. Natural contamination could occur, such as acid rain or radon gas, or as I brief, let's mention, the Cameroon's volcanic natural gases. And it wouldn't be caused by any third-party peril that would be covered by the policy. However, contamination in our case certainly did result from third-party conduct or negligence. This court in the Barnett versus Detmer case, which was decided earlier this year, basically set out a long series of principles dealing with construction of insurance policies and exceptions and exclusions under insurance policies. And if I understand that line of cases correctly, it says that where there are two reasonable constructions, and I believe that there certainly are two reasonable constructions in this case, that the construction of an ambiguous exclusion that protects the insured should be adopted, even though the construction that the insurer argues for may in fact be more reasonable.
Counselor, could I interrupt you just a minute? This remark you made just now that in our case contamination did result. Does that mean that you agree there was contamination?
I think factually, we agree that the condition that the property ultimately ended up in was a condition that you can reasonably conclude was a contaminated condition.
So are you saying your damages resulted in contamination?
No. The loss was not caused by contamination, because contamination was the condition that the property was in when the episode was over with.
Well, and are you saying that the third-party negligence did not cause contamination?
No, we're saying third-party negligence in fact caused a condition that can reasonably be described as contamination. So,
well, are you saying that the third-party negligence would cause your damages without the contamination?
I don't think so.
I'm just trying to tie down exactly what
we're saying. What we're saying is there's no question but what the word contamination. A reasonable construction could be that it would apply to the damages that our client suffered. But a reasonable construction of the entire cloth and its place could also be that it would have to be a loss that was caused by some natural form.
So your argument is on interpretation of the insurance contract.
Exactly.
Not on whether there was contamination which caused your damages.
That's exactly correct.
Okay.
Aren't you really asking us to read into the policy natural contamination?
In effect, we're asking you to recognize that under this particular policy, as written and as placed among these other natural policies, that contamination under this policy must be a natural contamination. And in order to reach that, you've got to kick in with the construction rules that the Barnett case and general line of cases require you to apply.
What is ambiguous about the clause? It says what it says. It says contamination is excluded. It doesn't say natural contamination. It doesn't say contamination caused by negligence or accident or anything else. Contamination.
Contamination.
What is ambiguous about that?
It can be construed in two fashions. It can be construed to define a condition that's not caused by third-party negligence, and it can be used to describe a condition that is caused by something that's covered under the policy. Contamination, as used in placement of this policy, doesn't give the court any kind of guidance as to which construction it's talking about. One of the things we looked at in this case, we put in a brief, was there are other exclusions of conditions as opposed to perils, like nuclear damage. In that instance, this particular policy directly excludes not only the condition of nuclear damages, but the condition of nuclear damages as brought about by any other covered peril. So we know this carrier can exclude conditions irrespective of their causation and their origin, but with reference to contamination, they've not done so. And we say that leaves clearly a situation where the construction, there's two reasonable construction that can be made with this clause, and we say that the one that excludes the clause cannot be adopted under the Barnett and the other construction cases. And that's our position. I think we would be out of line to argue that the policy cannot be construed to exclude this clause. I think it certainly can. It's just that under this set of circumstances, it shouldn't be.
How would we write, if we were to adopt your position, how would you write an opinion?
That the language permits itself the construction that it does not exclude the form of contamination that we found here.
But how would we fashion a rule that would apply not only to this case, but to all cases?
I think the rule has already been fashioned in the Barnett cases and the line of cases that say that where reasonable signs can differ as to how that language would impact upon this law. And we think it can in this case. That even though the more rational and reasonable construction might be the insurer's construction, that you can't adopt that, you can't resolve that ambiguity in insurance exclusions in favor of the carrier. But they must be resolved in favor of the insurer.
There have been a lot of lawsuits on all risk and homeowners policies. Isn't it the rule that if you are going to rely on an exclusion, since it's an all risk policy, that you have to specifically exclude the exception, that is, that you must specify in the policy exactly what the exclusion is, and it's never to be implied.
Exactly.
Isn't that a rather well-established rule of law as far as construing an all-risk policy?
I think it is. The Adrian case we cited.
Now, they say they have specifically excluded it. You say they have not specifically excluded it.
Exactly. that the use of the word contamination alone.
Contamination alone is generic, and it could be one kind or another.
Particularly when you use the word place as it is, with a whole paragraph of naturally arising conditions, rock, rain, and dampness, vermin, mice, insects. This is sort of a fish hook clause hidden in the natural causes exception of the policy. And it clearly does not speak to or cover the situation that the plaintiff's presented in this case, where a third party's negligence and disreputation was in fact found by the jury to be the cause of the loss. The real problem is contamination is a condition. And this exclusion says it talks about losses caused by something. And the contamination was not there to begin with to cause anything. The contamination is the end result, as Justice Wallace pointed out, it's the end result that we ended up with after all the negligent tort feeders had left. So what we've got is a term that we believe clearly is ambiguous, and in the context of the cases that we're relying on, including the Adrian case. The Adrian case was an underwater or water under the surface of ground exclusion, but the logic and the construction was identical to what we have here. And in that case, they had two exceptions, one that covered natural water, the other that covered unnatural water, and the third exception that didn't appear to cover or define which it covered. And it was the third exception they were relying on. In this case, we've got a situation where we say the contamination clause should not be extended beyond natural forms of contamination. And they say it should. That's where we are.
In that exception, it names a number of different causes, but separates them a semicolon.
Yes.
And the two semicolons that bracket contamination say dampness of atmosphere, extremes of temperature, contamination. What's the common element of those three?
Well, I believe dampness of atmosphere and extremes of temperature are together, and then contamination is separated by a semicolon on both sides from all the rest. So,
the copy I have doesn't show that.
No.
Shows all three of those bracketed by semicolons. Is that, am I incorrect?
I think that's the case. I mean, the policy okay. Here that I'm reading from, there are semicolons behind the words deterioration, fungus or fungi, temperature, contamination, and insects. And so that's our position. We're not here to tell you that a reasonable construction of this policy could not exclude our loss. It could. Obviously, the Federal Court of Appeals adopted that construction. We're simply saying that it's an ambiguous clause, an ambiguous insurance exclusionary clause, and once you hold that type of bird up to the light and follow the construction rule, which we believe that even the Federal Court of Appeals in Adrian has admitted to follow with regard to the construction of exclusion, that the ultimate all-risk policy should cover the loss, particularly when the jury has found that the loss was not caused by contamination, but was caused by third-party misconduct and negligence. And that's our position.
Give me an example of a contamination of the sort that you think is excluded under the policy.
For example, radon gas that would seep from the, as I understand, from the natural formations of the earth come up through the foundation of the home.
Did it have many radon-based payments? Claims?
I wouldn't think so. I don't know. But also something like acid rain. It's simply the problem where we have a third-party peril that probably is ordinarily covered, and we have an ambiguous condition that's supposedly excluded, and there's no guidance at all in the policy about what happens when the jury finds, as they did in our case, that the cause of the evasion was third-party negligence and not contamination.
Counsel, you've got a little bit of time left, and I hope you're going to cover the subrogation.
I'm just fixing to, assuming for a moment that we're correct with regard to our construction of the policy. Employers argued the trial court and trial court granted employers an offset to the claim based upon the principle that by settling with the tort feasor for $295,000 $350,000 damages, that the Altons had destroyed their subrogation rights. Well, it's undisputed in this case that there never had been any payment of this claim. The tortfeasor and the insurance lawyers sat at the same counsel table, made objections for one another during the trial, and took the factual position in front of the jury that Mr. and Mrs. Altman were crazy nothing had happened to their house, except they got it sprayed from above. These were just super sensitive people that had, psychological problems that led them to the courthouse. Well, after the lawsuit was over with, and Sherry had found against them on all points, they suddenly saw a different factual position that they had. Suddenly, they were proud owners of this claim, that we were, when we settled with the tortfeasor, we had impacted it adversely upon the precious right that they had as segregated parties. We say segregation is an equitable form of principle and law that first of all, is designed to prevent the insured from recovering more than their actual damages. Well, that's not presented here. Secondly, it's used where payments are made to prevent the carrier that makes those payments from losing their rights under a theory of resulting trust. Neither of those conditions are principles that support the equitable theory of segregation are here in this case. And we don't think the trial court should be allowing the carrier to use subrogation rights to defend against the primary policy itself.
What, if anything, does the policy itself say about subrogation?
Well, the policy itself says that they're entitled to subrogation for the amounts that are just for subrogation to the rights of the insured. But it doesn't say up to the amounts that they've paid. If it said that, I think we'd have a better situation to argue that until that day, there's no such thing as subrogation. But it doesn't. Once again, the policy's not quite so clear about just what their subrogation rights are and when they apply and when they don't. So there is a case that's cited on page 14 of our brief where this court in Ford versus State Farm held that where a carrier denies coverage, they operate as a waiver against their written consent to settlement clause. And we believe this is a sound rule, that they shouldn't be allowed to occupy a factual position that the claim doesn't exist and deny the claim. And then at the same time, once the jury comes in, change their factual position, say, oh, well, but now we have segregation rights. In preparing for today's arguments, I found some quotations that I'd like to give to you from work, 1978, four-volume set of books by Professor George Palmer, University of Michigan, entitled The Law of Restitution. And in sections 23.13 and 23.14 of that treatise, he outlines what he clearly believes to be abuses by insurance carriers under the general flag of subrogation clause. And two of the quotes were particularly probative, much better than I could have said it, so I'd like to read a couple of them. One is, he said, follows on page 420. Subrogation is a remedy designed for an insurer who pays. And when the insurer refuses to pay, it should be stopped to assert interference with its subrogation rights because of an act of the insurer occurring thereafter. In this case, clearly there's no doubt what the terms of that claim paid. And yet the subrogation that would follow that payment has been used as a defense or an offset or a credit or whatever you want to call it in the trial court to deny the offense an otherwise valid claim under this policy. We say the carrier has had its cake and has eaten its cake all at the same time. On page 433 and 434 of Professor Palmer's work, he states that with reference to the problem of overpayment when the insured doesn't recover all of its damages, there cannot be any subrogation offsets. He says, in those circumstances, no language of the subrogation clause should be effective to defeat the insured's right to indemnity as promised in the policy. The subrogation clause should not be regarded even by a careful and intelligent reader as qualifying the basic promise to pay. And to give it that effect is to enforce provisions drafted by the insurer that are inherently deceptive. And that's our position, but we don't believe that even subrogation existed in the trial court or exists here today. And for the trial judge to allow those rights to interfere with the collection of the policy was clear.
Does that gentleman cite any case authority he has lately?
Yes, he cites a lot of it, but a great deal of it is out of state. But I thought those particular paragraphs indicated basically our entire position with reference to what is and is not a subrogation claim. Thank you.
Here from the respondent.
And please, the court, Mr. Philip Gilbert will present argument for the respondents.
Good Court. I'm here today to emphasize a few key points in connection with the construction of this insurance policy. I think we need to begin by looking at the purposes of the different clauses that an insurance policy sets at the homeowner's policy. First, we have an all-risk coverage in this policy. So, if we have a risk or a peril or a loss that is recognized commonly in an insurance contract, it is covered under this policy. There's no question about that. Then there's a section of the policy which goes into exclusion. The purpose of an exclusion section is specifically to carve out, delimit, and define areas that are not covered. There is no purpose other than that for an exclusion section. No one section of the policy deserves more credit than the other section. It's not the purpose of the law to favor one section of the policy or any other section. All the parts of the policy comprise a contract and an agreement between the parties. The exclusion section is intended specifically to override coverages otherwise given. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any reason for an exclusion. The very purpose is to override coverages which we might otherwise find in the policy. Now, looking at the perils, the risks, and losses which are covered under the all-risk coverage of a homeowner's policy, there is no case in the state of Texas, and to my knowledge, no case in the United States of America, which says that negligent behavior per se, is a covered risk under an all-risk homeowner policy. Not one has been cited by opposing counsel that says that.
Isn't that really a red herring in this case? I noticed there's an amicus brief.
Yes, sir.
Does that really address the question before the court whether or not we don't need to decide that issue, do we, whether or not negligent behavior is covered under an all-risk policy?
Their argument has been that negligent behavior is covered. I'm addressing that argument. That
they don't need to adopt everything just because they've argued it either. Are we kind of construe an insurance contract?
If the peril is not covered initially under all-risk policy, we don't even need to get to exclusion. The only way
you mean to say it's relevant under an all-risk policy whether the peril was negligently created or was not negligently created. What's relevant about that?
I agree that that's not relevant. It's not relevant to the exclusion either. But what I'm looking at is, where is this loss covered under this all-risk policy? Is it covered?
But to say that if it's negligently caused, therefore it was never covered in the first place. Can you really sustain that?
No, and I disagree with that whole theory.
Okay.
The question of negligence, non-negligence, accident, or intention is not a question of coverage. There is no coverage for this loss under this policy. The place they find coverage is contamination. That's where they find the coverage. And that is specifically excluded under this policy. Contamination would otherwise be covered under an all-risk policy.
Whether negligently caused or not negligently.
Whether negligently caused or not negligently caused.
We're back on. Go ahead.
Yes. But contamination is specifically carved out in the section of exclusion part of the policy. The question was raised on initial argument about the paragraph in question. And it was emphasized that contamination is set apart from all the other perils listed in subparagraph I by semicolon. If the court's copies don't reflect that, the copy was bad. And opposing counsel admits that is set off by itself.
My copy does not have a semicolon after the word temperature. Does yours?
Yes,
does the policy?
The policy has that semicolon. So what we find there is contamination is set apart, as we said in our brief. This has significance. However, let's look at the other surrounding risks or losses that are mentioned in that subparagraph. And the one that was never mentioned by opposing counsel, because it doesn't fit in with their pattern of natural causes is wear and tear. Wear and tear is obviously a loss or a risk caused by human beings. We don't mean wear and tear by animals. We don't mean wear and tear by the atmosphere. Wear and tear means, as a common, well-understood meaning, of use by human beings.
How about dogs and cats? And people keep the dogs and cats inside, you know, and that can cause wear and tear,
too. Cause some wear and tear. But we don't think that the wear and tear here is only limited to the dogs and cats. That would be an unreasonable construction. So, this one was not mentioned because it doesn't fit into that pattern. There is no pattern here except that all the items create problems in the household. Vermin, moths, insects. Under their construction of this clause, if a neighbor brought in a dog while they were visiting, or a friend brought in a dog, a visitor, and the dog had a lot of fleas, which a lot of dogs have, and the fleas started an infestation in the house, the owner, being negligent, bringing in that dog, knowing about those fleas, knowing they might spread, that would create a covered loss, in spite of the fact that there's a specific exclusion for loss is caused by vermin, termites, moths, or other insects. It seems that each of these exclusions must be given a proper, well-understood meaning. Otherwise, we're playing tricks with language. We're being sophisticated. We're doing the very same thing that insurance companies have been accused of doing for a long time. And except this time, it's for a claim. We're playing tricks with the language. It was mentioned in the amicus brief, for instance, that if negligence were a covered peril, and then you have a limited peril policy, well, that's the fire policy. If the insurance company could say, well, yes, this was really caused not by the fire, but by the negligence of a party that caused the fire, therefore it's not covered. The unfairness of that kind of construction is apparent. The same unfairness applies here when flipped over and applied against the insurance company.
You have some pretty good cases supporting your position that contamination is an exclusion. And some factual cases pretty close in point.
Yes.
One, as I recall, out of Massachusetts.
Yes.
Discuss those cases. I think what we want to know is, we're looking at a word, contamination, in this policy. Should we hold that that's just a clear exemption, and therefore, since he's conceded it's contamination that he's out, or should we say it's ambiguous, and we rule everything against you, interpret everything against you? Where is the law? They haven't given us much law yet. Maybe they will in their clothes. What law are you going to give us to support your position?
Yes, Your Honor. There is no case, again, in the United States that I've been able to find that holds that contamination, that exclusion, is ambiguous. The two cases which we cite, one is the Fifth Circuit case, which is an impressive opinion called American Casualty Company of Reading, Pennsylvania versus A.L. Myrick. That was the Fifth Circuit in 1962, construed a Texas policy. That policy was an all-risk policy, like ours. In that case, there was a loss caused by ammonia gases contaminating an inventory. The claimant claimed that this was not, did not come with any contamination exclusion.
And that was in a refrigerator, and it came out of their own property.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just ammonia gas got left in some sort of refrigerator unit.
Yes, no, that's right.
What did the court say?
And the court said, in talking about contamination, the court said there is no ambiguity in the relevant provision. Whether the parties intend that a particular peril be excluded and that if that intent is clearly expressed, the effect should be given to the exclusion. And then talking about other secondary causes, or earlier causes, such as the claim this was really caused by ammonia, not by contamination. It's like saying this was caused by negligent application of pesticide, not contamination. And the court said to say that there was an external cause which was an approximate cause for the loss did not eliminate the exclusion from the contract. Since the evidence establishes that the Italian kids were contaminated, the exclusion of policy must be given effect. That case has never been overruled or questioned in the state of Texas, or anywhere in the United States. The Massachusetts case, which was in the Quake case, granted a summary judgment on that very point. That there is ban of it largely applied negligently by a pesticide applicator, and the court granted summary judgment for the insurer to say this is clearly comes within the contamination exclusion.
Anything else, counsel?
Your Honor, I wanted to mention briefly the fact that there are some very limited exceptions to these exclusions. They're very well-defined exceptions. And that's where we could have made a claim if his claim fit within those exceptions.
Because when you have risk coverage, and then you have a specific exclusion,
the claimant still has the possibility of recovery if they can come within the defined exceptions.
And here, they're laid out, and the claim was never made, and it would be untenable to make the claim that their loss
came within any of the exceptions to these exclusions. Cases
in California that are cited as dual cause cases invariably rely on two separate perils, covered perils, such as flooding, negligent construction, which is a covered peril in California policy.
Negligent construction is one of their covered perils. It's usually expressed as is in California policy.
When those two express the covered peril come together to cause a loss,
California law to the effect
that would be covered by the policy
in spite of
an exclusion of one of the two perils.
That has not been the law of Texas, and as petitioners have admitted,
this is not a dual cause case. There are no two perils which came together to cause this loss.
There was only one,
and that was contamination.
They say there was only one, and it was negligent.
They've gone and described the nature of the behavior which caused the contamination. They could also go one step back with that and say that it was actually caused by the private dealer, which is another exclusion.
And what this is really playing tricks with words.
The real common sense understanding of this is that the loss was caused by contamination.
What do you say about subrogation? Come on.
Yes, Your Honor.
On subrogation, petitioners not only settled this case, they really destroyed our claims in the very court,
in the very trial
that was taking place.
It was
the insurance company which joined
Allied Technical in this case as a third-party defendant.
And then the other case, which is Bittigan, Allied Technical, was joined into this case. The insurance company consistently claimed that all fault rested on Allied Pest Control. It consistently claimed that this was a contamination. And it consistently claimed that any loss it suffered would have to be recovered from the third party, Allied Pest Control. And the jury issues supported that, and they supported that judgment. Without notice to respond, the petitioner
ex parte settled their case with Allied Pest Control,
and ex parte,
without notice to petitioners, obtained a vacation of the jury verdict, not only by the title of their motion and order, but by the actual language of the order, vacated the jury issues against Allied Pest Control.
This was an intentional destruction of the subrogation rights granted in the policy and granted under common law. And the trial court felt correctly that this destroyed our subrogation and therefore caused a waiver of all claims against the insurance company. The Ford case, which was cited by
petitioners,
did not decide that in such a situation where an insurance company denies coverage, that the insurance company loses its rights of subrogation.
In fact, it expressly stated to the contrary. It did say
that it would lose, the insurance company would lose the right to be in control of a consent
of a settlement with
a third-party insurer. In that case, I believe it was an uninsured motorist insurer. In saying that,
it said
that the insurance company still has its rights against the wrongdoer.
They don't have this right against the wrongdoer.
How do you respond to the argument that you haven't paid any money? So why should you cannot have any subrogation rights unless you pay a law?
Your Honor, I believe that is explained by reason of the fact that in my practice, we allow claimants to settle all of the mutual claims against each other in the same trial. That is, in a situation where someone is sued for negligence, a cross suit can be made against another party. In case there's a recovery against them, they can have a right to the judgment of against the third party. Even though, under the old practice 100 years ago, that could not be done. And a party could not recover over against someone else until they have paid the judgment, and then at that time, the cross suit should be made. Modern third party practice encourages the settlement of all those disputes in one case, but not with the situation in this case. Those matters were submitted to the jury, they were pled by the party, and they were settled in this one case, but they were taken away, ex parte, by the petitioner.
How can the taking away of a jury issue hurt you if the jury specifically found that the loss was not covered by contamination? I mean, I don't understand. I don't follow your reasoning.
Because you
had a jury finding against you.
The jury findings were against Allied Pest Control. And they said the jury found...
Well, your theory of the case is that the loss was excluded because it was contamination.
Yes, but if it was not excluded, then Allied Pest Control was responsible.
Well, I don't...
It was pled and argued.
I don't understand your argument when the jury found against you on that issue.
Yes, the jury found that there was no contamination. Just like they did in Myrick. The jury in the federal court found in Myrick there was no contamination.
I just don't follow your argument.
Yes.
That's okay.
If I can't explain myself, the jury issue that we relied on and that we would have had a right to judgment on against Allied Pest Control were that Allied Pest Control was responsible, was negligent, had improperly applied the substances to the home. So if there was coverage under the policy, then the insurance company, under its subrogation rights, would have a right to judgment against the wrongdoer for those negligent acts. Those were found by the jury. The findings of those negligent acts and those damages by Ally were vacated, taken away from the insurance company, taking away any possibility of obtaining a judgment.
If we hold there's coverage, what do you want us to do with the subrogation?
Your Honor, again, if there's coverage, it seems that the subrogation rights have been destroyed, and that in that case, that the petitioners have waived their rights against the insurance company, and that there still should be no judgment against the insurance company. At the very least, there should be no judgment for the damages portion of the jury findings. And similar to what the trial court did, I think the trial court's theory was there could be still attorney's fees in favor of petitioners because initially, if there was coverage, petitioners had a claim against the insurance company. They may have destroyed that claim, but they did have it.
If you had coverage, what would normally happen would be you would pay the loss and then you would undertake to subrogate against the wrongdoer.
Yes,
and get your money back.
And that right has been destroyed by settlement.
Well, has it been?
Well, it has been destroyed in one way by the jury findings being taken away, but also by an indemnity agreement, which is a part of the record. The petitioners have indemnified the wrongdoer against any losses that would be recovered by our company. Therefore, another reason for not granting a judgment is that you lead to each party having a claim against the other. They just wipe each other out.
Yeah, you just leave, if even we found coverage, that it was not excluded by contamination, you say we just ought to leave everybody where they are.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the result of all of the matters of record, including the indemnity agreement. It would seem that it would be a waste of judicial efforts to retry a matter, find the pesticide company negligent after they've already been found negligent, and then after that, that the Ottens have to pay the judgment for the pesticide company under their indemnity agreement. It seems that proper construction would be what they simply could be no recovery in that situation.
Well, you'd have to be a stop on their
part. Yes, if the court has no further questions, that's all we had. Thank you very much.
How much of your loss did you recover from the pesticide company?
The total damages were found by the jury to be about $361,000. We recovered $295,000 in settlement. So there's some $70,000 or $68,000, something like that.
What's your answer to the question? If we found coverage for you, what rights do you think you still have against the insurance company?
We say that the equitable principle of subrogation is one that, first of all, you have to pay the claim that has not done it. And secondly, you have to have clean hands before you're entitled to equity's assistance. And when they show up in the courthouse and sit with the tortfeasor and defend against the claim that they say now it's there, to make a factual posture in the judicial process, it doesn't exist. That they've done more than not pay the claim. They not only not paid the claim, they frustrated it to the nines and did that done a good job in front of the jury. So they've taken a factual posture and a legal posture that should, and we believe does, stop them from doing so.
Well, the Chief Justice's question was, how much do you think you should be paid?
Oh, I misunderstood. Under the policy, the damages that were awarded amount to the finished market value in the home, which is $12,500, and there's an additional recovery. The total recovery that we prayed for in the court of appeal is $27,500, so I think it was $10,000 additional extra living expenses funding. In addition to that, we have attorney's fees, which, interestingly enough, the trial court awarded attorney's fees, but not all of the attorney's fees. Only the attorney's fees found in the trial court. So we have a most superior judgment in that regard as well. We ask that that be stated.
Well, you're not asking for the full amount of the face value of the policy?
No. No, that's correct. Starting with a different subject, Justice Wallace asked me about what authority Professor Palmer cites on page 420 of his volume 4 of that set of books, The Law of Restitution, at footnote 12, for the proposition that subrogation can't exist without payment of the claim, he cites Powers versus Calvert Insurance Company, 216 South Carolina 309, 57 Southeast 2nd, 638. Apparently that's the subject of ALR annotation 16 ALR 2nd 1261. The first of all, we have a situation where the Myrick case, the one that appears to be the most offensive to the position of the petitioner, in that case, the policy was different from the policy in this case. In the first case, the peril insured against were all risk of direct physical loss, and the contamination clause was separate apart from all the rest of the exclusions and specifically covered contamination only if it was caused by or resulting from contamination. The policy that's before the court in this case is a policy that ensures all risk of physical loss, direct, indirect, from what, if it's a physical loss, is covered. So he's up here talking about covered perils and uncovered perils. The truth is, anything that causes a physical loss to the dwelling, you start off with the idea that people have insurance for it. We're talking about two different policies. Our contamination clause is nestled in between a bunch of rats and brain and damp exclusions. And this other one was well
separated by semicolons.
Separated by semicolons, that's correct.
What significance do you place on that, if any?
I'm not sure any significance on the semicolons. I found books that tell me that semicolons are meant to separate, and I found some that tell me that they're meant to show where items are similarly describing one another or setting out. I'm not sure that semicolons have any place a role, or if they do have a role, it's not one that's understood by me.
Three ex parte Rodriguez about 1872 in this court.
We're not as anxious to become a semicolon court. It's one thing to distinguish your opponent's cases, and I understand the need for that, but where are your cases?
The only case that I think gets close to where we are in terms of describing contamination as a natural contamination by reason of placement and so forth is this case that I cited earlier, the Adrian case, the 1982 Dallas Court of Appeals case. It's not in our brief. I have the cite.
Why would you come to the Supreme Court, if I might ask, with your best case, not in your brief?
Because I didn't find it.
Okay.
The Hallmark case, the one that the Court of Appeals used to judge, is nowhere mentioned in the Adrian opinion. Now, I have found another case, the Park case, which is on all four with Hallmark, and that's how I trace it down. But it's, quite frankly, just third-party neighbor. I just didn't find it.
Are we going to get it?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll be glad to give you in case of supplemental brief.
Is that your best legal shot?
I think in terms of Texas law, applying the ambiguity provisions or ambiguity law and natural cause exclusion, I think that's it.
Do you have a contamination case?
No.
You can get into the Lexus and find one?
We can't find one that I'm aware of. The problem is we don't have a policy that's as immediate as one that we bought. So that's our position. Now, one other thing you're talking about is the setting aside of jury awards and jury verdicts and so forth. On page 105 of the record, if you look at the order that sets aside the jury finding, this specifically says that it's set aside only as to allies. Only between the Dolphins and allies. So obviously the findings dealing with adverse findings on the contamination clause are not between the plaintiffs and the court. And so we don't believe that order did anything that destroys the subrogation rights that we argue don't exist anymore.
We're going to take a short break.
Y'all,